Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm going to talk to you in a little bit of detail about three different topics that have caught my interest and are going to be examples of what is going on at UCSB. Another aspect of UCSB's work is this term called self-assembly. And I think that's going to be an essential ingredient of making things easily, and this is the engineering aspect of a lot of the work, is that you really don't want to have to go in and micro-manipulate your carriers. You'd like them just to come into being when you mix things together. So we're going to talk a little bit about how this might happen with a system of liposomes that we have created with a multiple nesting compartment. Basically, the technical idea is the same one you have at the grocery store. If one bag is good, double bagging must be better. And so we'll tell you how to double bag things at the nanoscale. The second thing is a little bit more generic method of targeting and releasing contents either from cells or from artificial cells like the lipid carriers I'm going to talk to you about. And we're going to do this by focusing laser light onto gold nanoshells. And the particular light we're going to use is in the near infrared, which is where we all happen to be relatively transparent, so that we can get into our tissue without damaging. So we will talk about that, and then that's actually using this laser as kind of a bomb so that we can explode things. And of course, that appealed to my 13-year-old boy inside, because everybody wants to blow stuff up when they're 13. And then we're going to turn this light into a little bit more of a scalpel and actually show how this light can be used to pattern the delivery of genetic material and turn particular protein processes on and off in living cells. And not only living cells, but turn something on in this cell while leaving an adjacent cell unaffected. So our motivation is pretty simple. We're looking at the general problem of efficacy versus toxicity. And basically, any type of drug needs a certain concentration to be effective. And almost all drugs, if you put too much in, have some sort of a toxic response. So what you'd like to do with a drug delivery system is to lower the effective dose that you need to introduce into the system while increasing the level of drug that gives you this toxicity. And that combination of things is what's called the therapeutic index. It's this ratio of the toxic dose to the effective dose. And so what a good delivery vehicle is going to do is going to deliver more drug to the site of interest so that you can do both things at the same time. And there's not going to be any one particular magic bullet that is going to be able to deliver any drug or any genetic material to any particular thing. And there's a number of different routes that are going on at UCSB. I'm going to talk to you first about a nested vesicle structure called the vesosome. And it's called the vesosome because all the good names were taken. And we are working on this as a way to extend the encapsulation of drugs in the circulation. Dr. Ruslati, whose name I spelt wrong, I put the H in the wrong spot, is working on polymeric micelles that are with a carrier and targeting agents to try to deliver material to specific cells. Craig Hawker of our materials research lab is creating polymer structures, dendrimers, and other types of polymers to deliver drugs. Samir Mitragotri, our chair, has been developing polymer lipid hybrids to try to mimic red blood cells. And I'll also tell you about gold nanoshells that are heated, work I'm doing in collaboration with Norbert Reich of our chemistry department. So we can go anyway, and the main unifying characteristic of these things is that we are at least in some aspect of these structures at the nanoscale. And we have to understand that in order to get any further. So our vesosome came out of, if you'd like to be fancy about it, a mimic of the eukaryotic cell. So a multi-compartment structure can do more things than a single-compartment structure. And really, what it came from is my experience as a bag boy at Stater Brothers Market when I was 18. It takes a little bit more work, but basically all we're doing is putting one lipid bag that can be of a different composition inside of a bigger lipid bag. We do this to try to optimize the function of each of the bags to get a better retention and control over drug release in the circulation. The other thing is that we can put almost anything we want of colloidal dimension inside of a lamellar bag using some pretty simple phase behavior. So this is what we have to do. And one of the sort of guiding principles of engineering is trying to keep things simple. I don't know if that's a guiding principle of medicine in general. It doesn't seem to be. But we'd like to do everything so it's scalable and that the only steps that we have to do are heating things up and cooling things down and mixing. Those things we can do pretty efficiently. So what we do is we take lipid vesicles made out of certain saturated lipids, and we mix them with a little bit of ethanol and water. This causes a change in the bilayer structure that normally happens. Instead of the normal bilayer, the ethanol causes the layers to interdigitate. And as you interdigitate those layers, the membrane gets stiffer, it can't bend as well, and so it makes flat sheets. So now we have open sheets of lipid in our solution. We can remove the excess ethanol, and we can add whatever we'd like to that we want to encapsulate. It could be vesicles, it could be other nanoparticles, it could be drug particles, etc. We mix it together and we heat it up. This heating process makes the membranes more fluid again. They close like thousands of little butterfly nets around whatever happens to be in solution, and we encapsulate. In this process of encapsulate, we don't catch everything. You never catch all the butterflies. And so we do some separations, and then we can go test this. And this is what it looks like at the microscopy level. We have particles on the 50 nanometer length scale. These are small vesicles trapped inside of a bigger membrane. And why do we do this? And it turns out that we get an incredible extension of drug release in serum. This is a little graph of what happens when we put Cipro, which is a nice amphiphilic antibiotic that happens to be fairly difficult to deliver, into one of these carriers. If we just have a single membrane, in serum, the half-life of the Cipro is about 10 minutes. And this is because there are thousands of things, and perhaps Dr. Hood can tell us all what they are eventually, that like to eat lipid in your bloodstream and like to break down membranes because that's their job. They don't know that this is a good bag as opposed to a bad bag. So putting in a bag inside of a bag, a lot of these things require transport into the membrane and even transport to the surface of the membrane in order to work. Lipases, enzymes, and cholesterol agents, high-density lipoproteins. If you have two layers, you have to go through one to get to the interior structures. And this just takes some time. And so we see an increase in half-life of the drug from about 10 minutes to more than 8 hours, which gives us the opportunity now to have the release time be greater than or equal to the circulation time that it takes us to get to the particular organ or tissue that we're trying to deliver the drug. The vesosomes go nicely through our volunteer here. I always like the medical terminology that it was sacrificed. It looks like he's really the only one that's doing much of the sacrificing here. But we can incorporate various dyes, and these are near-infrared dyes, into the membranes, both the interior and exterior membranes, and actually follow the biodistribution of these things to see that the half-life is on the order of 3 hours, which is less than the about 8 hours of retention time that we have for encapsulation. And on the far side, the red fluorescence is just the background fluorescence of the various organs. The green fluorescence is that of the vesosomes being delivered. You can delineate the various organs where these things are accumulating, as well as the major blood vessels as the drug is slow, or as the vesosomes are slowly metabolized. But can we actually then label these things and target specific tissues or organs? And this is work with the Ruchlotti group as well as Patrick Doherty's group, and he'll be telling you more about this development of different sorts of peptides in the next couple of talks. And what we are looking at in this particular project is trying to target these vesosomes to atherosclerotic mouse aortas. And that is actually very hard to say, especially when you need a drink of water. But what we're trying to show is that you can get a certain amount of specificity. Here we can see there's slightly more fluorescence intensity, especially around the areas of the axial atherosclerosis with a Krika plaque-targeting peptide. And this might have actually been better, but in this particular experiment, one of the unfortunate things about atherosclerosis is it actually kills mice just like it kills other people. And so before we could actually let all of the background go away, the mouse died. So we're continuing to work on this, but we're seeing encouraging results. But it got us to thinking about enhancing the targeting and enhancing release. With every antibody, there's going to be two things that at least Dr. Doherty has taught me this. There's affinity and selectivity. And it's really hard to get both. And those of you who make antibodies and do this sort of thing know that this combination, if you can get both, you have a great thing. But what if we could enhance the selectivity via an external probe? And that gave us the incentive to try to put something else into our packaging. And that is these things that we call hollow gold nanoshells. And they are just what the name implies. They're just little pieces of gold in an eggshell shape. And if you hit these things with very short pulses of near-infrared light, they get very, very hot. They're extremely good absorbers of near-infrared. And near-infrared is our favorite wavelength because this penetrates fairly deeply into tissues. And when this happens, like I told you before, the 13-year-old boy in me gets excited because things blow up. Weren't any of you ever 13-year-old boys? Didn't you want to blow stuff up? Uh-oh. Maybe this is a pathology I have rather than something typical. Good thing I made it past that age without actually blowing up anything important. So what this helps to do is that we can separate these tasks. Drug retention and primary targeting might be due to the carrier itself and antibodies on the carrier, whereas we could do controlled release and enhanced selectivity with the nanoshells. So this is why we chose the near infrared, is that it's a region of the spectrum where physiological medias are the most transparent. Blood, tissue, etc., just don't absorb light in the roughly 800 nanometer wavelength. So we might be able to stimulate these things in places where we wouldn't be able to stimulate them otherwise. Regular gold particles, those that you just form by natural processes without a little manipulation, happen to absorb light very well around 500 nanometers. And as you can see by the color of the cuvette, if we do a little bit manipulation of the size and the shape, we can move this absorbance directly into this near-infrared window. And I'm not a chemist, so the chemistry that we need to do this turns out to be very simple. Basically, it's no harder than making spaghetti with ragu. This isn't even, you don't even have to go to the store for real stuff. All you have to do is dump a little bit of silver with reducing agents to make a particle of silver roughly the size that you want this interior cavity of the nanoshell to be. Then you just add a gold salt. And it turns out that gold lights the plate out on silver with no specific work on your part. This is just because its reduction potential is higher than for gold than it is for silver. So it just starts to grow on the outside of the silver particles. This consumes the silver, and it leaves a shell of gold behind. And this is what they look like in the electron microscope. They are just little eggs of gold. You know, they're not Fabergé eggs, but, you know, I think this is pretty spectacular stuff, as easy as it is. So we can put these things together. We can put them inside of lipid membranes. There's the lipid membrane. This is a little bit different way of looking at it with the electron microscope. Those are the nanoshells. Gives you an idea of the rough dimensions. We can just mix the nanoshells with the vesicles. Or we can use some more chemistry that will become a little bit more important in a few minutes. Lipid, PEG, thiols that actually tether these things to the outside. And then we whack it. And we whack it with femtosecond pulses of near-infrared light. And it turns out that we can deliver all of the contents of the drug. Here it's a dye, but we can also do Cipro, DNA, a number of other things, within 5 seconds of the zap. Everything's released. And the amount of release depends on the power input. And as you can see for the blue line, there's a certain power that we need to exceed in order for this to actually happen. It also depends on how close we are to the membrane. If we tether these things right to the membrane, we get almost 100% release. If we just mix them inside, we get a little bit less. And if they're further away, we get a little bit less. But all this happens, all this stuff goes on, and the bulk temperature change is negligible. So we're blowing stuff up and leaving no trace. So we're going through and we're actually seeing that this threshold for power density is distinct regardless of where we put the HDNs. And what's particularly fun is that the liposomes themselves are still there, but our hollow gold shell has heated up enough to actually anneal and condense back into a solid particle. So we have a temporal membrane rupture which induces contents release, which suggests a mechanical rather than a thermal rupture because the lipids are still there. And with Samir's help, we listened, which is an unusual thing for professors to do. We normally talk. And what we listened to was the pressure fluctuations in the solution. These pressure fluctuations told us that we had bubbles forming and collapsing. We're boiling water, but we're boiling tiny amounts of the water, just like you do when you throw something in a sonic cleaner. So you have little cavitation events. And we saw no such pressure fluctuations when we did the control things. So it's the collapse of the transient vapor bubbles that actually does the destruction. And while we're blowing these things up, are we damaging the contents? This shows you a little bit of about the particular dye we used with LC mass spectrometry. And the contents were fine. There's no degradation to small molecules, no degradation to high molecular weight DNA either. So basically, we can go ahead and blast these things, and there's a very high local temperature, but this doesn't extend very far into the solution. So the contents remain intact. So maybe we can turn this into more of a scalpel than a bomb. And one thing that we have recently accomplished with Dr. Reich and Gary Braun, a very good graduate student in chemistry, is actually releasing molecules from the HGN surface. So what we have are thiol gold bonds. We hit this with low intensity light, and the molecules can diffuse away and start reacting. Here we've labeled them with a fluorescent molecule that's quenched in the presence of gold and fluoresces when it's further away. So we've put these things and made a little bit more complicated package. We've coated the gold shell with a siRNA sequence that is cleaved and released with the laser intensity. We also put on some molecules to help it get inside of cells, along with a lipid bilayer to make it a little more compatible. And what we're capable of doing is turning on and turning off, in this case, the green fluorescent protein. And we can do this now in a patterned fashion. So the DNA dye, or the RNA dye, is red. In areas where we have blocked the laser, it's still sitting around inside the cells. Where we have unblocked the laser, it shows up or it disappears because it's being used up in order to actually do the silencing. So the dotted line is at the interface, and you can see that on one side, we have primarily silenced GFP, and on the other side, the GFP is still going strong. So we can not kill the cell by controlling the laser power. We can release various molecules from the gold nanoshells into the solution inside of a cell. So with that, my time is up. The people who actually did this work in my group, Dr. Gohui Wu and Ben Wong, Shelley Esikoff did the HDN synthesis based on work by Dr. Brian Prevost. Natalie Forbes is the new graduate student working on the project. Gary Braun did the siRNA work. And we have help with the electron microscopy and actually the laser light scattering as well. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if I have the time. And thank you for your attention.
thinking about this intersection of engineering and medicine, oh, we have a little bit of cutoff here. Let's see if I can fix that. Pardon me. Try one more time. That looks better. Okay, this intersection brings to mind this painting by Fritz Kahn. Some of you may know a Stuttgart artist from turn of the last century. And really, we could think about the intersection of things like artificial organs, which I've been using a variation on this slide for some years, and the list gets longer every time I put it up now. Stretching all the way down to that last one has to do with the vestibular system and control, balance control. At the same time, the challenges you're hearing about in this session have to do with delivering a therapeutic agent in a very controlled manner, so controlled delivery of an active agent or a therapeutic, and there are a range of applications, and this is a mere subset of the total range of things in which these engineered approaches to controlled delivery are intersecting with important medical problems. So this topic of controlled drug delivery cuts across the session very broadly here. You can think of the challenge in getting a therapeutic agent administered dynamically. And we heard from Joe in the last talk about ways to actuate this, ways to engage the particle to deliver it. The challenge from my perspective, and my background is really coming from control and dynamic systems, is to think about what is the profile you'd like to achieve with that drug. Rarely is it constant. It might be constant, but even holding a constant concentration is a challenge in many applications. More often than not, when one tries to emulate nature, you've got the challenge that the naturalistic response could be cyclic or pulsatile, or in the case of insulin delivery, biphasic. And you're trying to emulate that then with your engineered system. Maybe triggered by the environment, you need something that's going to be appropriately sensitive. So a broad category of things in controlled drug delivery really have to do with trying to achieve the release of an active, indicated by this cartoon here, into an optimal dosing strategy. And again, my background is control and dynamic systems. So we spent quite a bit of my career looking at these kind of materials and working with material scientists in optimizing designs of those polymers. But today I'm going to talk to you more about the algorithmic side of this problem. That is to say, if you've got a device that you can control with certain degrees of freedom, what's the optimal way to respond to cues and release that drug or that therapeutic agent? So that's really going to be the focus of what I want to talk about. So the topic that was in my title slide, the artificial pancreas, has generated a lot of buzz in the press lately. If you follow the endocrine community or you follow the diabetes science and technology community, there have been a number of headlines that suggest we're poised and ready for this innovation in the artificial pancreas. If you don't follow the more technical journals, you can't help but see this. The CBS Early Morning Show had a piece on, if you can't see the font here, artificial pancreas for some diabetics. And even the ABC World News had a piece on the artificial pancreas within the last year here. Many of you are familiar with Steve Jobs' very effective advertising campaign for the iPod. We have an app for that. Well, the folks in this community are also seizing that, and this is more of a tongue-in-cheek description, but I think we're not far, and there are a number of us working in the field that are looking at applets that one might put on something like a PDA to actually deliver the technology to control these devices. So diabetes, type 1 diabetes mellitus is the world's most common and costly disease. It's, I believe, the only grievous disease that's increasing in the number of individuals afflicted. If you look at the top 10 diseases, about one in every 400 to 600 children and adolescents has type 1 diabetes. And really, everywhere the blood flows in the body, one has the possibility for the insult or the side effects of the disease. And you see a short list here of some of the complications. And this is really where the cost in treating and dealing with the disease comes in. There was a very detailed study, which is really the gold standard study in this field, a little over 15 years ago, in which they supported the notion that intense intervention could be beneficial for the treatment of type 1 diabetes, that is actively intervening with insulin in a very high-frequency manner, not just three times a day associated with meals, could reduce some of the complications. But the same study also concluded that there's a danger in that active intervention, that one could potentially overdo it. And overdo it in this context refers to the fact that you may induce hypoglycemic incidents as well. So there's a very fine line we have to walk between bringing treatment that minimizes complications and doesn't endanger the safety of the patient, and that's the challenge in this area. So a few statistics on the cost of diabetes. There's the cost in the human dimension, which is, of course, very sad in terms of those afflicted. It can be translated, if one could, in dollars as well, and it runs in excess of $100 billion a year and is projected to climb the total cost out in 2020, projected to climb to very close to $200 billion a year. These are estimates in the U.S. from the healthcare system. So to get at the solution to the problem, we need to understand how nature does it in the case of an individual who's healthy who doesn't have type 1 diabetes. The pancreas is a remarkable hierarchical control system that in its own right does a marvelous job of regulating glucose. When your blood sugar, for example, is high, the pancreas is stimulated to produce insulin in the beta cells. That production of insulin leads to a lowering of the blood sugar because the insulin modulates the activity of cells in your muscles and your fat cells that then can take up the glucose in the bloodstream, and that'll bring down your blood sugar. The pancreas is rather versatile, however, and it also has a second counter-regulatory hormone, glucagon, which has the opposite effect. If one has a low blood sugar, the pancreas is stimulated to release glucagon. That leads to the production of glucose from glycogen stores in the liver, which will ultimately elevate the blood sugar. So the body, in effect, has a rather versatile dual control, or the brakes and the gas, if you like, in the form of insulin and glucagon, respectively. So if one looks at this problem now from an engineering perspective, we have very mature technology for sensing blood sugar in the body, much like the beta cells sense blood sugar in a healthy individual. We also, over the course of the last decade, have witnessed the advent of a number of technologies for delivering insulin, effective ways either implanted within the body or more commonly externally, subcutaneously, to administer the insulin. And the grand challenge really is how we close this proverbial loop. How do we take actionable information from these glucose sensors and transduce that into then instructions for the pumps to optimally release that insulin? So back to the problem I described at the beginning of my talk, what's the optimal dosing strategy? How do we use this information to forecast and make intelligent decisions with the delivery of insulin? So one could think about doing this with high-end computers and very detailed patient models, and of course, unless you're in a bedside application, this isn't very practical. Over the course of the last several years, we've moved to thinking about your cell phone as a potential platform for delivering this technology, and we've demonstrated in clinical trials with our partners at Sansum day-to-day control with very modest computational requirements. As I'm going to show you in this talk, we're moving towards solutions that truly could be solved on an integrated chip, and then that chip could be put in the pump, could be put in the sensor, could be put in your cell phone, could be embedded in your clothing. There are a lot of different ways to imagine realizing this. So to give you a flavor for the challenge of the problem, I'm showing you here two charts. In the case on the right, this is a healthy individual who's going through a time course of a day. This is a day's worth of data. This is actually a graduate student on a Friday afternoon who went out for pizza and beer that evening. And what you can see is his pancreas did a very effective job at regulating a nearly rock-steady blood sugar. And what you see on the right is actually a patient with type 1 diabetes that also has been optimized, but in this manner by the medical doctors. Have sort of hand-curated, worked closely with the subject over a long period of time to really optimize their insulin delivery so that they have a profile which is not very different from the profile of an individual without diabetes. The challenge in this field is to translate that intelligence from the doctors and make this an automated solution for all subjects. And that's really the challenge. And the reason it's such a challenge is here's a typical subject who's managing their own diabetes. This is a month's worth of data I'm showing you here. The green lines here denote the safe zone where we like to keep their blood sugars. And what you're seeing is that very frequently they have high excursions above the limits of what we'd like to keep them within, so hyperglycemic excursions. More dangerously, perhaps, they also have excursions below the green zone and even a few that go below this red line, which take them dangerously close to hypoglycemic episodes and running the risk of being put into a coma. So this is the nature of the challenge, trying to minimize or bring down the variations in this blood sugar by doing an optimal dosing of insulin in this case. So the approach we've taken in a wonderful collaboration we've enjoyed now for about 8 years with Sansum Diabetes Research Institute here in Santa Barbara is to marry the engineering and the algorithm design from the engineers from our campus with the intuition and the medical experience of the doctors and come up with different ways of now automating this pump to combat the glucose variations. And I'm going to talk about a few of these technical terms that you see on the slide here, but it really is a, if you will, a medically inspired approach to the engineering. And we couldn't do it without this wonderful partnership we have with the MDs. And I'm not saying this just because one of our partners is in the front row here. So the technology, as I mentioned earlier, we have the ability to measure the glucose. We have, that is to say, companies have developed the technology, and we can now get glucose tracings that sample every 5 minutes to report back the subject's blood glucose. If you think about the time constants or the nature of the dynamics associated with glucose metabolism in the body, it's on the order of 30 minutes of time constants, meaning a couple of hours for us to process, let's say, a good-sized meal. So 5-minute measurement resolution is actually quite good, is suitably real time. By the same token, now the ability of these pumps to administer in a very fine-grained way the insulin has also gotten to a marvelous level. Again, an example of some of the pumps that are in the market right now. What you're seeing here in this plot in the gray would be the naturalistic release of insulin by the pancreas. So this is the beta cell function in a healthy individual. And what you see in pink is an attempt to recreate that profile by a series of basal adjustments, that is the requirements for insulin in the absence of meals, coupled with some bolus releases, which now the combination of these two magenta curves is meant to approximate the profile of insulin you would see in the body in a naturalistic manner. And the key, again, is how do we automate this for all subjects, all different meals, all different stress states during exercise? It's really a grand challenge in terms of dealing with patient variability. So we've developed here at UCSB a platform for doing this called the Artificial Pancreas System or Artificial Pancreas Software. The idea is that we can now integrate these variety of sensors and pumps, and this is showing you right now the products on the market that we've worked with, the vendors we're working with, to integrate. So now we can make these devices talk through telemetry, through wireless radio communication, so there's no tethering of patients to cables, to clumsy laptops and things like that. It can all be done wirelessly. We have a software interface. I don't want to belabor here, but this is key because we do many of our clinical trials with international collaborations. So we may be running a telemedicine trial where subjects in Tel Aviv are being tested with our protocols, and the doctors and engineers are here in Santa Barbara seeing an interface like this and tracking the progress of the clinical trial. And so we do a lot of hardware in the loop testing, just like an engineer would do this with a new device for an automobile or for an aircraft. You do the same thing here. You take the actual physical components, you wire them together to talk just like they would in a real application. The only thing missing in this case is the subject. So before we dare to hook this up to an actual human being, we make sure that all the devices are able to communicate, there's no faults, there's no interrupts, and we emulate the patient by putting a computer model of the patient on a laptop. And so we've taken all the pieces of the loop except the patient, and we've tested and verified that we've got a fail-safe algorithm. So the approach that we take, just to sort of summarize in one slide, to automating this is something called model-based control. This is an approach that has been used for probably close to 4 decades in the chemical process industry. People have been running refineries using this kind of approach for about 40 years. And the idea is really quite intuitive if you think about it. The idea is that if I have a subject and I'm able to somehow describe in a mathematical manner the behavior of that subject, how the subject's blood sugar will respond to insulin, for example, I can compare a measurement from the patient with my model prediction and use that as the basis of feedback. Because really, feedback and feedback control is correcting for mistakes. If I'm trying to maintain the temperature of this room at some target, and the temperature drifts from my target, I've made some mistake because the door's open or 75 people walked into the room, something happened, and I need the feedback to tell me, okay, how far off is the temperature, high or low, and make that adjustment. If I had a perfect model to predict the temperature of this room with 75 bodies, an open door, the various equipment that's in here generating heat, I never need to check the temperature. I would just always do the right thing with the air conditioner. Same thing over here. If I had a perfect model, of course, there are no such things. But if I had a perfect model, in that limit, I would actually never need to do feedback. So what this does is it reduces the feedback problem to the essential issue, which is what's the difference between reality and my perception of reality, and that's how I correct and make adjustments. So that's the art of what we're doing here. To get a little more technical, it's implemented in what's called a moving horizon concept. So I take the history of what I've been doing with my patient, the blood sugar measurements, my model prediction, this wavy line here. The staircasing line here is what the insulin pump has been doing in the past. And as I gaze into the future, perhaps I want to raise the subject's blood sugar because they're a little low. I make a forecast with my computer model. How do I get up to the target? And I calculate what are the series of moves by the insulin pump that will get me there. Then I collect a new glucose measurement, and I repeat the whole process. Just like a game of chess, we're forecasting ahead several moves. As soon as the opponent makes a move, I forecast again several moves ahead. It's the same principle. In terms of the mathematics, for those who are interested in such details, we're solving what's called a quadratic program. I put a penalty on how far from the target I've deviated. What's the penalty for actuation by the insulin pump? I put a model of my patient at the core of the algorithm, and I put certain limitations, like the fact that I can't take insulin back out of the body, so insulin can only be put into the body, and there may be upper limits on the pump characteristics. I may have other constraints as well to factor in. So how do I come up with a mathematical model, then, as the basis of the algorithm? I've said it's model-based control. Well, we can do experiments, and these are some of the clinical experiments that are done by the MDs in the lab here, where you can actually introduce, let's say, a meal for a subject, and you can delay the delivery of their bolus. The reason we do this is if you superimpose the meal and the insulin bolus, you have counteracting effects, and it's very difficult to tease out separately what was the influence of the meal versus the influence of the insulin. So we separate them temporally so that we calculate from the rise, the influence of the meal, and from the fall, the influence of the insulin bolus. We can use this then to make mathematical models. So this is what one of our math models will look like. The formula is not meant to be hieroglyphics for you here. The idea is to say that we can take multiple values of their past glucose measurements, and we can use that to correlate with the past couple of values of insulin that was delivered, as well as the past couple of values of carbohydrate that they consumed. So we're building a tailored or individualized representation of each subject based on an experiment of the kind that I showed you on the previous slide. And for a given subject, we may collect hundreds of those kind of data points, and we're going to fit something on the order of about 8 coefficients to the subject's response. So this is at the heart of the algorithm, is a customized description of the patient. Okay, so I said this is a 40-year-old technology. It's been used in the petroleum refining industry for decades. Of course, we're not going to take a petroleum process control algorithm out of the field and plug it right into a medical device. It wouldn't translate directly. So what we really need to do is customize things. And we've done this in a couple of different ways, innovations and working with the doctors here. I'm only going to have time to really touch on the latter two here, which are the efficient way that we deploy the algorithm actually on the device, on the chip. And second, some safety constraints that we've built in as a way of ensuring safe operation for the subject. So this implementation of the algorithm on a chip really comes from the pressures we've been experiencing from the FDA. So to do our clinical research trials, we are subject to the same stringent reviews that a company is subject to by the FDA in putting a product on the market. So we actually have to go through all of the risk analysis and safety confirmation just as a company putting a new product out. So what we're able to do is we're able to take the mathematics I put on that earlier slide and reduce it to effectively a lookup diagram, which is what this cartoon here is meant to represent. So if I have a subject, imagine this is glucose and insulin on these two axes. If I take a measurement, and I know what the insulin concentration is, what the glucose measurement is, I can put myself in one of these quadrants, and I have an analytical expression for the solution here. So I'm not telling the FDA that I've got to go solve those equations that I had on the earlier slide, but rather I've got a lookup table, and it's sort of color-coded here just for illustration purposes, but it gives me a way to confirm I know all the scenarios, I know all the possibilities of what that algorithm will do, hence I can ensure certain boundaries on the safety and reliability for the subject. And so if we put this in, for example, this is just an in silico simulation of a patient response. Here you're seeing the blood sugar would have gone very high without insulin. Indeed, with a bolus of insulin automated by the algorithm, you're able to bring blood sugar down to a much more reasonable value. And I know it's a very tough axis to read here, but what this is showing you is each dot indicates a different region that we've bounced around in computing the solution. But these are memory operations. This is looking up a solution on a chip. This is not an energy-intensive operation by that computer chip. So the second innovation that we've made to MPC for the safety of the patient is this idea of calculating insulin on board. So we know from the pharmacodynamics, and I know a lot of you in the room here are familiar with PK/PD type modeling, that insulin remains in the body in an active form for up to 8 hours. So if you take an insulin correction for a meal, and later discover that your blood sugar is still high, you have to account for the fact that you've still got insulin circulating in the body. You don't want to over-administer the insulin. And this is well known by the clinicians. In fact, the pumps on the market today have so-called bolus wizards that allow one to calculate that insulin residual that's remaining in the body and subtract that from any additional insulin you might add. So how is this useful in the context of the automated insulin delivery I just spoke about? Well, one of the challenges for us in automating insulin delivery is we're very much behind the game compared to the pancreas because we're measuring glucose in a slow way through subcutaneous tissue, unlike the pancreas, which has access directly from the bloodstream. We're also administering insulin very slowly, subcutaneously. So we've added 5 to 10 minutes of lag on each of those sides, the measurement and delivery, and now we have a much slower feedback loop than the pancreas has. So that means when we design our algorithm, we need to make it very aggressive, very responsive, but the risk is we over-deliver. So we design a very aggressive algorithm, but we put a constraint of limiting how much insulin can go in based on pharmacodynamic information about active insulin. So the pumps will come with these kind of curves, which show you the so-called decay curves of as that insulin is consumed in the body or is degraded as it is circulating, how long is it remaining active? We can pick the appropriate curve for a subject, build that in the algorithm, and that becomes the safety override that we won't exceed when we deliver the insulin. Okay, so in terms of evaluating this, as I said before, the FDA is holding us to a very stringent standard, the so-called investigational device exemption. These are products on the market, but we're putting them together in a way they weren't intended, and that's why we need the FDA oversight. They've already given us an acknowledgement for that APS, so that's now a separate, almost like an appendix that you can cite in an FDA application for a protocol. We've done phase one in working with an FDA-approved simulator for simulating the effect of insulin on the body for a type 1 subject. We've gone through a couple hundred virtual subjects in simulating the protocol that we're testing in clinical trials. And we've also begun our human subject studies. So the first cohort of patients were actually in Israel. We're able to get up more quickly a study running there, and I'm going to show you an example from that. We're hoping to get through the FDA oversight late 2009 is our current target, and we're part of a very large international trial that's going to kick off in 2010 and have about half a dozen sites around the globe testing these protocols with subjects, about 100 patients in that larger trial. So in the in silico trial, this is just an example of the kind of testing we've done. We ran 100 subjects through. These are 100 adult subjects in the in silico database that was generated by a group in Italy. And you can see that our blood sugars all remain in the so-called A and B zones, which are very safe zones to maintain blood sugar. That means, for example, if we look at this plot here, this would be a mean response of those 100 patients, plus or minus standard deviation, and ultimately plus or minus worst case response. In the very worst case, we're only tipping up above 200 milligrams per deciliter, a very reasonable response for an algorithm that's purely feedback. The algorithm knows nothing about the meals the patients are eating. It is blindly driving through those meals using strictly feedback information. Likewise, we're very safely above the lower margin for a hypoglycemic threshold with no concerns whatsoever in that category. Of course, this is all on the computer. What does it look like in real life? Well, let me show you a snapshot. This was a trial that we ran. We're up to 10 subjects now. This was one of the subjects back in March. You're going to see a video that shows you as the trial was progressing what the algorithm was doing. So the initial part of the trial here involved getting the subject from an initially high blood sugar to administer the algorithm administers insulin. We're initializing, bringing them back down closer to the target here, which is what you're going to watch over time. This is their blood sugar on the bottom. This is insulin delivery on the top. I want to point out the green curve here is that safety limit or that safety override. That's the margin we have to give more insulin. So that becomes the hard constraint. So on the bottom here, we're bringing our subject down, back down very close to target. And what you're going to begin to see, if you look at the upper plot, unannounced meals coming in. And at about the same time, we're building up capacity for insulin. That safety limit is now rising because it's been long enough since the insulin administration to now allow additional insulin in the system. There was an unannounced meal, which means, again, it's blind to the algorithm. The algorithm can't cheat and say, oh, you told me you're eating a quarter pounder. I know what to do. The algorithm strictly is working on a feedback basis. And what you'll see now is that the effect of the unannounced meal is going to be a rise in blood sugar. Let me stop this again. And what you were seeing here were the model were forecasting. This was those chess moves into the future. The model was forecasting blood sugar will rise. Hence, the algorithm began to pump insulin. And that insulin was pumped up until that threshold or that safety limit. And that's as much insulin as we could put in and be safe with the algorithm. Now what you're going to watch is truly remarkable is we're going to see a very quick turning of the corner. The subject's blood sugar comes down very quickly. Catch it one more time here. And you can see in a very short span, less than 2 hours or approximately 2 hours from the unannounced meal, we're bringing the subject back down to a normal glycemic range. This is truly an impressive demonstration, the first demonstration of an unannounced meal compensated artificial pancreas or closed loop. Okay, I want to start winding down and just give you a hint of how we're thinking about this problem as we go in the future. And two of the biggest challenges that I see in this area are safety issues for the subject. I've talked a little bit about that, but we can do more in this field. And the real challenge here is the fact that if this were a room full of individuals with type 1 diabetes, your manifestation of the disease as each of you would be very different. Furthermore, your manifestation of the disease this morning, this afternoon, tomorrow, next week would also be remarkably different. And that variability is really the big challenge here. So in terms of safety, the big issue here, and I think one of the first innovations in a product on the market is going to be a hypoglycemic alarming system, a system that forecasts when you're going to get into trouble. We want to see a system like I showed you in the movie that does everything in an automatic manner and manages blood sugar. We're some years away from that, I think. But I think the first thing that's going to hit the market, and we're seeing precursors of this already, is something that can deal with the fact that we have subjects who have very low incidence of their blood sugar and yet don't respond to nighttime alarms. Their pumps may be beeping or their sensors beeping at them. They're non-responsive. This is the middle of the night. This could be an adolescent or a child. This is somebody who's not responding to those. And in a very unfortunate and catastrophic situation here, I had a subject who went into a seizure. Because for a very long period here, they were ignoring the fact that their glucose monitor was beeping and they were trending in a dangerous way. So we'd like to be able to forecast those trends and automate perhaps a shutoff of the pump or a decrease in the delivery of insulin. And so the approach that we're taking here is we're actually marrying about five different numerical schemes. So if there's any electrical engineers in the audience, you may recognize a couple of these algorithmic titles. If you're not, don't worry about it. What we're basically doing is taking five of the best approaches that are available in the field. We're applying this in a so-called voting scheme. We want to minimize false alarms, both false positives and false negatives. So if we bring a cohort of algorithms to the problem, we can get a much more robust estimation that something has happened and we need to take action. And so what this might look like, for example, here's actual data from a clinical test where you've got a subject whose blood sugar is trending down. This is the point that you want to identify early on. When will you cross the threshold of 70 milligrams per deciliter? And what you see down here, these horizontal lines, are the different algorithms giving indications that there's going to be a problem. They're alarming. So, for example, if my threshold were simply that two of the five algorithms told me trouble was coming, I would know about 50 minutes ahead of time and at a very safe blood sugar of 115 that there was a problem being forecast. If I'm a little more conservative and I say I want three of five algorithms to tell me something's coming, well, 45 minutes ahead, still in a very safe level, I'm forecasting trouble. If I'm even more conservative and I want all five of my algorithms to tell me something is going to happen, well, I can get to about 35 minutes ahead of the incident, still a relatively safe blood sugar, and I could take action. So you can tune this algorithm depending upon your risk aversion to give you the appropriate alarming specs and then take you the appropriate action. The last thing, as I mentioned, is variability, and really one of the big elements of variability we find is the influence of stress on the body's response. So this can be everything from the anxiety of having to give a talk in front of 100 people, the anxiety of taking an exam, the physical pressure of illness or exercise. All of these things have similar manifestation in the body in terms of glucose metabolism. And so we've begun clinically evaluating this by giving an emulant or a simulant for stress. The doctors administered prednisone with a cohort of subjects here in a study a couple years ago and studied the changing influence of their insulin requirements. And so we calibrated very carefully then what the corresponding glucose averages were over the course of the multi-day trial, what the changing demands for insulin requirements were, so we could begin to titrate or recognize when there's a change in the demand for insulin because of stress and how we compensate for that and either raise or lower the insulin requirements. So it's just a very beginning of trying to understand that, but I think this is going to be one of the grand challenges in this field is understanding whether it's illness or whether it's the physical stress from exercise, how one then modulates these algorithms to cope with that day-to-day, subject-to-subject. Okay, so what I've tried to tell you about here is this field that I come from, which many refer to as systems engineering, I think really has tremendous tools and capabilities to bring to this problem of the artificial pancreas. I've shown you a couple of the promising technologies using patient models to customize automated delivery, putting safety limits on that, and to realizing that algorithm in a way that one could put it on a computer chip in a very simple manner. Lots of challenges, and I don't have time to get into these in detail, but I made it sound fairly straightforward, but coming up with reliable patient models is a very hard part of this problem, and we're still working on that. This is more for the vendors, but the sensors right now do not have a very long life in terms of how long one could leave them in the body. Furthermore, there's complications with sight issues that the body begins to sort of compensate for the compromise that one has, let's say, in the skin. I mentioned patient variability and omnipresent for all of us. It's important, and I know it's for the safety of the patient, but there are a lot of extra hurdles that the FDA is throwing at us that slow down the pace of research sometime, which make it a little more difficult. So some acknowledgments. The team is a tremendously exciting and dynamic team here. We've got folks in the audience. Eyal and Howard are in the front rows here. This partnership would not be possible, the work we're doing here at UCSB, without Lois and Howard and the other folks at Sansum. It's really bringing the MDs and the engineers together that are enabling the advances that we're achieving here. And, of course, all this requires bills to be paid, and the folks at NIH, the ICB here on campus, JDRF, as well as Roche, have funded various aspects of the studies here. So I thank you for your attention.
If you could use this for multi-parametric sensing and delivery, how much more complex does the math and the engineering become at that point where you want to deliver two drugs or three drugs?
Brilliant question. And let me step back from that and say the version of this algorithm that's implemented in a refinery controls hundreds of variables, hundreds of actuators with hundreds of measurements. So there's no limit on the technology itself. I think it's our understanding of those interactions between, let's say, multiple drugs and how much we can capture that empirically or with first principles descriptions. But if we can capture those with the models, that's the hard part. We can certainly implement
that. So math and engineering is solved.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.